The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Loyal listeners will recall, oh heck, practically everyone who's ever heard of marijuana is probably aware that weed is currently listed in Schedule 1 of the U.S. Controlled Substances Act. That's the most restrictive classification. Total ban. Not allowed for medical, nor for any other use. Of course, my home state of Oregon brings in millions of dollars in tax revenue every year from legal marijuana sales, so it kind of begs the question of just how relevant is the CSA in the 21st century. We'll look at that and more on today's show. But first, the Home Affairs Committee of the United Kingdom's House of Commons issued a report on August 31st that broadly calls for a major overhaul of the UK's drug laws and policies, endorses harm reduction, and supports the piloting of safe drug consumption spaces and expansion of drug checking services. From the committee's news release, quote, in a report published today, the committee calls for a new legislative and funding framework that enables practical, risk-reducing interventions, such as establishing a pilot drug consumption facility and drug testing at festivals. It further calls for a move away from an abstinence-only approach towards harm reduction with improved cross-working between police, health, and social services. End quote. UK Prime Minister Sunak and his government ministers have 2 months in which to respond to the committee's recommendations. Now, this story has so far gotten surprisingly little attention internationally, but it's causing quite a stir within the UK, particularly in Scotland. The following exchange in the Scottish Parliament occurred during First Minister's questions on September 7th. The question is put to First Minister Humza Yousaf by Emma Harper, member of the Scottish Parliament for South Scotland.
To ask the First Minister whether he will provide an update on the steps that are being taken to reduce drug deaths in Scotland.
First Minister.
We remain absolutely committed to delivering the national mission to reduce drugs deaths and improve lives of those that are affected by drugs. The latest drug death statistics that reported a 21% decrease in 2022. I do welcome that reduction, which is the highest on record, but I'm also quite clear that these numbers, of course, remain far too high, and every life lost is an absolute tragedy. My thoughts are with the families that have been impacted and affected. That's why the national mission includes an additional £250 million investment over the course of this Parliament to improve services and backs radical approaches that are evidence-based, and that phrase is absolutely crucial, whether that be a proposal to establish a safer drugs consumption facility or arguing for drug law reform. The Minister for Drugs and Alcohol Policy will make a statement later this month to update Parliament more fully.
Thank you. Emma Harper.
Thank the First Minister for that response. The Misuse of Drugs Act is over 50 years old. It's not fit for purpose and it must be reviewed urgently. And the Home Office, the Home Affairs Committee recently published a report calling for a review of drug classification and a new health-led approach to tackling drugs with a trial of safe consumption rooms. So can the First Minister provide an update as to what engagement the Scottish Government has had with the UK Government regarding the urgent need to reform of the Draconian Misuse of Drugs Act?
First Minister.
The points Emma Harper makes are well made. And in July, the Scottish Government did publish a paper, as Emma Harper said, setting out our bold and ambitious proposals for drug law reform to ensure we treat problematic drug use as a health, not a criminal matter. And I was heartened that there was much support for it, not just domestically, but internationally and globally, from experts and those who are working on the ground to tackle the issue of drugs misuse. This is complemented by the recent very welcome report, as Emma Harper said, from the Home Affairs Select Committee, which is clear for the need to reform the Misuse of Drugs Act. The Minister for Drugs and Alcohol Policy did meet with the UK Minister for Policing on Tuesday this week and did raise the issues with him. And what I would say is that if the UK Government won't take the necessary actions to use the powers that they have to help us to combat this challenge, this problem, this crisis, then at least devolve the powers to us so we can take a different approach here in Scotland.
That was Scotland's First Minister, Humza Yousaf, responding to a question by Emma Harper, MSP for South Scotland, in the Scottish Parliament during First Minister's questions on September 7th. This is all very good news, and yet, bluntly speaking, policy statements and debate are just talk. While politicians talk, people die. As harm reduction activist and reform advocate Peter Krykant, one of my personal heroes, told the Daily Record on September 1st, quote, "The Scottish government said it would go it alone 2 years ago, yet the Lord Advocate still hasn't come up with a framework that will allow safe consumption facilities. This just isn't good enough," end quote. The Lord Advocate, also known as His Majesty's Advocate, quoting from the Scottish government website, quote, is the senior Scottish law officer. The following are the Lord Advocate's main functions: head of the systems for the investigation and prosecution of crime and investigation of deaths, principal legal advisor to the Scottish government, representing the Scottish government in civil proceedings, representing the public interest in a range of statutory and common law contexts, end quote. Perhaps her office has been listening to Peter Krykant, because on September 11th, Scotland's Lord Advocate, Dorothy Bain, KC, issued a statement on piloting a safer consumption facility. Quote, on the basis of the information I have been provided, I would be prepared to publish a prosecution policy that it would not be in the public interest to prosecute drug users for simple possession offenses committed within a pilot safer drugs consumption facility. End quote. This is a developing story. We'll bring you more news when it happens, so keep tuning in.
Sometimes the form of the law is such as to render impossible its effective violation as a method to have it repealed. Sometimes the grievances of people extend more than just the law, extend to a whole mode of arbitrary power, a whole mode of arbitrary exercise of arbitrary power. And that's what we have here. We have an autocracy which runs this university. It's managed. We were told the following. If President Kerr actually tried to get something more liberal out of the regents in his telephone conversations, why didn't he make some public statement to that effect? And the answer we received from a well-meaning liberal was the following. He said, would you ever imagine the manager of a firm making a statement publicly in opposition to his board of directors? That's the answer. Well, I ask you to consider, if this is a firm, and if the Board of Regents are the Board of Directors, and if President Kerr, in fact, is the manager, then I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw materials, but we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to have any process upon us, don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up being bought by some clients of the university, be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone. We're human beings. And that brings me to the second mode of civil disobedience. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Turning now to U.S. drug policy. The Drug Enforcement Administration is set to review marijuana's placement in Schedule 1. The White House set the process in motion on October 6, 2022. The Department of Health and Human Services carried out the first part of that task by conducting its scientific review. That review then goes to the DEA, which conducts its own, much broader review. DEA then issues its decision. There's a process. The HHS recommendation was leaked. Now, for the first time, HHS is recommending that marijuana could be moved from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. It's just their recommendation. DEA still has final say. I mean, a big question is rescheduling even something that any reformer should be supporting? I mean, that whole ball got rolling back in 1972 during the Nixon administration. I guess rescheduling made a kind of sense back then, but it was very much a strategy born of desperation from a much different era. So what's up with this review, with this recommendation, with this whole scheduling thing? What's it all about? Well, there's only one person to whom I would turn for the answer to those questions. Shalene Tidal. Shalene Tidal is an Indian-American attorney and longtime drug policy activist who's been writing, passing, and implementing equitable cannabis laws for over 20 years. She's a former top regulator for the state of Massachusetts, where she served as commissioner of the Cannabis Control Commission from 2017 to 2020. Since 2021, Shalene has served as Distinguished Cannabis Policy Practitioner in Residence at The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law's Drug Enforcement and Policy Center. She's a founding member of the Cannabis Regulators of Color Coalition, and currently her primary focus is running the nonprofit think tank Parabola Center, which pushes for cannabis policies to protect people rather than corporate profits. Shalene recently recorded an explainer about rescheduling and this whole situation, which she very kindly gave me permission to share with you. Here's Shalene Tidal.
So this video is for anyone who cares about marijuana policy because you're a user, or because you care about drug policy in general, or any other reason, because we've had a very significant policy development in the last couple of weeks, but there is so much misconception and misleading information around it. So I want to clear that up. If we haven't met before, my name is Shalene Tidal. I run Parabola Center for Law and Policy, which is a 501c3 nonprofit. And we are focused on a vision for legalization that is based on racial equity and public health and not the corporate-led path that we seem to be going down, which would lead to domination by big pharma, big tobacco, and big alcohol. So quick recap. So before the last election, right before the last election, President Biden announced that he would be pardoning some people for marijuana convictions and instructing his administration to review the scheduling federal status of marijuana. So quick recap, you're probably familiar with the Controlled Substances Act or the idea of controlled substances. They are on five different schedules. So the most restrictive, as you may know, is where heroin and marijuana are placed currently. And the purpose of these schedules is ostensibly to rank them by medical potential and potential for abuse. And it's a highly politicized process, and it determines how difficult essentially it is to access and use these drugs. So Schedule 1, heroin and marijuana. Schedule 2, cocaine, rare circumstances, right? It has medical use. That would be legal. Schedule 3 is ketamine and steroids, for example. Schedule 4 is like Xanax. You go to a doctor, get a prescription. And then Schedule 5 is like codeine cough syrup, which might be behind a counter. So those are some examples about how it gets from most to least restrictive. So the process goes, one part of the Biden administration makes a recommendation to the other part. And there was a leak last week that the first part, the HHS, made a recommendation to move it from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. The biggest misconception, if I have to summarize it, is that this has been represented as a step in the right direction, but not enough. So it's true that it's not enough because rescheduling would largely not affect the most important things like criminal penalties, and would leave the war on drugs basically intact. But the misconception is that it's progress, that it's a step in the right direction. And here's why that's wrong. It is a step in completely the wrong direction because it is fully contradictory with the way that marijuana is used and the way that it is sold in the states where the majority of Americans live, where you can just go to a store and buy marijuana if you're over 21, which would be similar to alcohol or tobacco, which are not in any of these schedules. That is totally contradictory with Schedule 3. And it's kind of like the emperor wears no clothes because not a lot of attorneys and industry experts like myself are pointing this out. It's like if when alcohol prohibition ended, instead of simply adding another constitutional amendment, right, they had said, okay, you can use alcohol, but in some way that is completely out of line with the way people use it, right? So like, you can't drink alcohol, but, you know, if it's loose and solid, or if it's, you know, turned into a gas and administered at a hospital, you know, then you can access alcohol. Like, would you consider that progress? Would you consider that a step in the right direction, but not enough? It doesn't make any sense. And I feel like a lot of people kind of understand that, but it's not being said. So I want to validate that. Then I also want to address like the rational question, which is, okay, if it's in Schedule 1 and we put it in Schedule 3, which is less restrictive, isn't that better? Like, isn't that a step in the right direction? Which would make sense. Like, that is a very rational question, but it's not. So here's why. So when it's currently in Schedule 1, all of these states that are operating their own intrastate, meaning no exports or imports, they are operating under state control and regulation. So the federal government could, it has the authority to enforce its own federal laws, but in recent years, at least, it has chosen not to. But there is no federally legal path to using or selling marijuana, right? So what Schedule 3 would do is create that path for the first time. And we don't know what that would look like because it's all uncertainty and it hasn't happened yet. But two things are a safe bet. One, it can't be done with a plant. Almost for sure, it can't be done with a plant in the way that we know the marijuana plant. Because the process that you would have to go through requires the product to be the same every time, right? To be standardized, tested, labeled, not a flower, you know, that you dry and smoke. And that is a huge problem because the process that you would need to go through, and this is the other thing we can be almost sure of, is extremely expensive in order to be compliant, right? Like, arguably, even the largest cannabis companies today couldn't go through that process because they're pretty much all small and medium-sized companies in the grand scale of things because the largest companies don't want to touch something that's federally illegal. But if it's rescheduled, that would change. So this concern has been raised and it has been largely dismissed in my observation. What they say is two things. One, they say, well, if the federal government wanted to enforce its laws, it'd be doing that already. So why would that change? That's not a fair statement because it's not a fair assumption because the federal government's priorities change over years, right? Like it was only under President Obama that we had raids on medical marijuana dispensaries, right? And it was only one decade ago that we got state legal cannabis. We have no idea what the federal government is going to do in terms of enforcement in general, and if there's a change in scheduling. And I would argue, in fact, that there are reasons why they would step up enforcement. The other thing that they say is, well, don't worry about this happening because the process would take years. And then the conversation kind of ends there. The FDA approval process would take years. The testing would take years. That is not a satisfactory response because yes, it would take years, but it would still be a problem, right? 3 to 5 to 10 years down the line. And, you know, I would ask, like reading all of these responses, why, how could anybody be so short-sighted? And I will tell you why. It's because, at least in the mainstream press, I'm not talking about like people who study and write about marijuana exclusively, but you know, the folks who are just covering this because it's a big deal, you know, they are talking to the same four corporations. And those four corporations are looking at the tax break that they would get. Which they would. There would be, because of a weird rule that only applies to Schedule 1 and Schedule 2, if it was moved to Schedule 3, all cannabis businesses would be taxed at a much more fair rate. Instead of like 70%, it would be more like 10 to 30%. So that's a huge tax break. Also, their stock prices are artificially juiced right now, skyrocketing. They're looking at that. They're looking at CEO executive pay. They're looking at things that are not going to last more than a few years. You know, after I've been doing this for like 20 years, so I've seen this cycle. After 5 years, they're going to go to psychedelics or AI or, you know, whatever the next like moneymaker is. And so, yeah, they're not working on enforcement if it's not going to happen in the next few years. But if you're somebody who is concerned about policy and the way that people are treated and how this is going to play out over the next generations, then this is something that you have to worry about, because there is a good chance that pharmaceutical companies will look at this and say, okay, you know, maybe I wasn't worried about this before, but here is an estimated $79 billion industry, which is the same as wine. If I have the chance to be the first to go through this federally legal path that now exists, which didn't exist before rescheduling, then probably I'm going to do it. Let's try. Let's try and make a FDA-approved Schedule 3 product. So you know what would happen at that point? And yes, it might be years from now, but it would still be a problem. Every existing business, the thousands of small businesses, would be illegal. The consumers using those products, the patients using those products, would all be breaking the law, everyone except for this now federally legal product. So the problem is we would be creating this like system of legal and the underground market. And if you want to know how this might turn out, just look today at how the underground and illicit market is being treated. If you live in New York or California, probably just need to open up a newspaper today. You know, there's probably a story about it. The legal companies are calling for a crackdown. And what they're saying is, we are the clean, regulated, compliant companies, and the dirty black market is not complying, and you need to crack down on them and you need to arrest them. This is happening every day. And so it's quite easy to imagine what would happen in that case. And you also have to think about the scientific and medical community. They are almost obligated to point out in that case, okay, this other product, it's been tested. There's been trials, it's gone through the FDA approval process versus a plant, right? And so if we don't take a step to exempt the plant or to keep it legal, or, you know, to make that the first step right now before we go and allow this other path to be created, we're being really reckless. And I think that when we think about state regulators too, we have to understand, I was a state regulator. These are not courageous, bold people. You know, it's not part of their job. If they are presented with the choice of protecting these small businesses that are now all part of the illegal market versus going with this one other product, I don't think we should expect them to protect these companies either. So this could go really bad, I think, in a way that is not being intentionally put into place, but it's predictable. So you might ask, why haven't I heard much about this? I think it's because the response has largely been two separate buckets. And one is those same four corporations, or, you know, whoever it is that's focused on the tax breaks and the stock prices and their short-term ability to pay investors, which are understandably, you know, their concerns right now. And then there are the folks who are rightfully saying, hey, this doesn't affect criminal penalties. This doesn't affect deportations. This doesn't let people out of jail. Everybody's right. And it's sort of split into like the industry reaction and the advocacy camp. If you haven't heard of the concerns that I'm saying, they're equally valid, but they haven't been as represented because I don't really know why, but I think it's important that we recognize this. It's because it's not so visible, right? It's not like a short-term concern that's going to happen tomorrow, but it's still a very real concern. And it's one that the choices that we make right now are going to impact. So here's the fun thing. People often say, Shalene, like, I admire what you're doing, but corporate consolidation is inevitable. You know, just look around. Like, we should just accept that that's what's going to happen and try and get our seat at the table or whatever. No. And the reason I refuse to accept that that's inevitable is because if this is a political choice, and I believe that it is, it's about seeming cool and impressing young people, really, right? Like, that's what just doing something before an election that has to do with marijuana is about. And if people are educated and informed and they're like, actually, this is not cool, that would make, I believe, a huge difference. And I think that you as an ordinary person, whatever influence you have, you should use it because you have more influence now on this than arguably any other major topic. Because this is only going to happen once, right? It's only going to be legalized once, and then we'll be stuck with what we have. So if you care about this, you should do something. Now, I think that as we're paying attention to the fact that it is concrete policy choices that would lead us to corporate consolidation, it's not inevitable, that we really pay attention to these calls for a crackdown on the illicit market. Because even today, that's a very concerning direction that we're headed in. And that's just with companies with very few resources. And so if we had a big pharma or a similar company calling for a crackdown on everybody else, I think they could be much more successful with resources that they have. And so if we understand all of this risk and we say, still, you know, it's something, we should take what we can get. And I acknowledge that there are some small businesses that do need the tax break that badly, or there may be some other reason why rescheduling is that important to you, then at least make that decision intentionally, right? Then, you know, then I support you and I respect that. But we have to understand and direct this process. We cannot cede the details to corporations or we're going to end up sorry, frankly. So I want to close with something that someone said at a protest at the MAP Psychedelic Conference earlier this summer. In the closing, there was a group of Indigenous people who went on the stage and they said, we have no choice but to protest. And I'm going to read their quote to make sure I get it right. So they said, we open our medicines for you to heal, not to take, not to extract. You're being deceived. The same happened to tobacco, which now causes cancer. The same happened to opium, which now causes addiction. Please look at the cycle of colonization that continues to happen. We're in it. We're in the cycle of colonization, and no one is going to stop it but us.
That was Shalene Tidal. She's a distinguished cannabis policy practitioner in residence at The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law's Drug Enforcement and Policy Center, a founding member of the Cannabis Regulators of Color Coalition, and founder and director of the nonprofit think tank, the Parabola Center. You can find the Parabola Center on the web at parabolacenter.com. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for Community Radio, syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website at drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.